Can you tease a messenger? Teaching the youth about roots and culture. And tell them I see them to remember Jah. That's all I need when I am. Well, CKUT is a messenger. Teaching the youth about roots and culture. And tell them I see them to remember Jah. That's all I need when I am. Well, 90.3 FM. It's CKUT, the cultural radio station. Radio McGill. Blessed love. The messenger. Take it away.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy. The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance. We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required. Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. We are kicking off today's show with an interview with the woman behind Yoga Is Dead. Yoga Is Dead is a podcast that explores power, privilege, fair pay, harassment, race, cultural appropriation, and capitalism in yoga. They tell us about how they got started, as well as some of the topics that their work delves into. So can you tell us about yourselves and how you met? And what made you decide to make this podcast?
Yeah, so this is Sejal here. I'll just tell you a little bit about my teaching journey. I started in 2013. teaching in vinyasa yoga, and then I started to get more training in various different topics. So I traveled from New York to Kerala, India for several different yoga teacher trainings focused on vinyasa yoga, hatha yoga, and restorative yoga. And then I've also trained in trauma-informed mindfulness-based practices through the Lineage Project here in New York. I have a background in prenatal techniques and some anatomy around the pelvic floor that I've learned through Living Now Yoga. And then in terms of all the other things I offer, I started a People of Color and Allies yoga series to honor inclusivity and diversity. I lead free yoga for all in the Battery in New York's Landmark Park downtown. And we just finished our sixth year, or we have two more weeks to finish that out. And I really aim that at democratizing yoga offerings. It's free and it's accessible for all. You can come, you can sit, you can practice if you want. I lead retreats with topics covering asana workshops, those trauma-informed practices I mentioned, and pelvic floor anatomy. And I also created a ABCD Yogi, which is an international community that supports any born conscientious Desi Yogi, which means a person of South Asian descent, to reclaim the yoga and mindfulness space by sharing their personal stories and practices with the whole world. And then I was featured on this year's 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World list. And on top of that, so on top of the podcast work that Jaisal and I do, and on top of ABCD Yogi, I also offer group vinyasa and restorative yoga classes at Humming Puppy, and I offer private yoga, and occasionally I offer level one and two Reiki. I also volunteer with the Lineage Project in a finance and operations capacity. So that's me in a big nutshell.
Jaisal here. I have been teaching yoga since 2010. And like Thajal, I've done lots of trainings in this world, everything from Raja Yoga in India, Vinyasa Yoga in New York, prenatal. I've done meditation courses. I've done including a Vipassana training, the whole gamut, and tons of anatomy and mobility and all of those types of things. And so my teaching really focuses on making yoga accessible and empowering to the students that I work with. And supporting practical functional movement and lasting change. Most of my teaching centers on private yoga teaching, but I also teach one group class at the moment at a residential gym. And then I teach on staff at a couple of trainings. I've taught in the past anatomy and biomechanics. I also teach the portion of a prenatal training, the Mahamama prenatal training. And through that program, I also offer free and low cost classes, through their alumni program. I also teach I'm guest teaching rather with Prema Yoga Institute's therapeutic training. I volunteer with World Spine Care Yoga Project, and I am the co-creator of the 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World in 2019. So that's me in a nutshell.
Wow, amazing. So what got you guys together to decide to make this podcast, Yoga is Dead?
Thajal here. I'll just tell you a little bit about our story. When we met back in 2015 at a specialized teacher training, and like it was at that training that we formed our relationship, which started as friends and colleagues, but then became like a support system, and we became each other's sounding boards because of these experiences we were going through together in that first teacher training, where we experienced a little bit of silencing and negativity around the knowledge that we brought to the table, being Indian American women and yoga teachers who had trained in India. That wasn't received very well in that training. And we share a lot about that in our episode one called White Women Killed Yoga. And it was at that point that we realized that what we were feeling personally, of feeling isolated and frustrated and at a lot of times even angry, it wasn't unique to just me as a person. It was, we both shared those feelings. So going through that helped us to realize, like, this is a common thing potentially for people. So fast forward to 2019, about 4 years later, after we'd stayed friends and like really continued supporting each other through the journey of teaching and navigating the yoga industry, we came up with the idea for a podcast. So we got to a point where we needed an outlet for all of our stories outside of just speaking and supporting one another. And I just want to say like about the podcast, and you had asked us why we think it takes up space in a different way. People have mentioned, and we know that our podcast is a political sounding board because we take a look at the yoga industry as opposed to the teachings of yoga. So throughout the process of making this podcast, I just want to say that we felt really vulnerable and insecure about sharing so much personal stuff, but we needed to share a message that felt authentic to our real life yoga experiences and not just a like a quote, think positive and everything will be okay, philosophy podcast. And then we didn't really want to start with another interview style podcast because we knew that we were the ones that had the experiences and the stories to tell. So we didn't want to dilute that message right off the bat. And we also recognize that we represent kind of a unique demographic within the Western wellness world because we are women of color. And because we are Indian American women, or they see women teaching yoga. And then I realized really personally that I have been so hungry for more representation of Desi people in yoga, which is partly why I started that ABCD Yogi community. And it was surprising to realize like we didn't need to wait for anyone else to take up that space. We had enough interest, ideas, and offerings to take up that space. And that's what got us to really June when we launched our first episode.
Yeah, and I'm really happy that you did take up that space. I feel like I've been waiting for this podcast for so long, like as a concept. So I'm really glad you guys made that move. You mentioned it was vulnerable to create this podcast. You do delve into a lot of themes. Can you talk about how you go about choosing these themes for the episodes and how you go about tackling these topics? Because they're really vast and big and systemic. So can you tell us a bit about that process?
Sure. We chose the themes after a lot of deliberation. So the process was that we started this podcast process like over 2 years ago at this point. And we sort of went through an iteration of it for, you know, about a year. We probably didn't work on it as seriously as we do now. But over that year, we were kind of like thinking about all the things we want to talk about, mainly revolving around our personal stories. And then after that first year, we sort of went back to the drawing board and said, you know, we don't think this is compelling enough as is. So let's reorganize it. And that really helped us to focus in on like, what do we want to do? We want to point out some of the things that are really going wrong in this industry, and that's why these things have happened to us. And then from that point, start to give action items. So far, we've released 4 episodes, and in the way we have organized them, it's the same method. We suss out what the major touchstones are for each of the episodes. We use our personal stories and our research to highlight the points we want to make. And then we know we're speaking to 3 different audiences: the yoga student, the yoga teacher, and the yoga business owner. And so we end the episodes with action items with each of those audiences in mind.
In your last podcast, for example, the theme about vinyasa, at times even you both come at it with different kind of perspectives or values, or not values, but different, I guess, takes on it. So how do you kind of bridge that when you guys have different takes around it?
This is a great question. I think what actually we didn't tell you is that when we first started this podcast idea, Sejal and I had completely different viewpoints on so many different topics. So even though we have such a similar background, we had similar experiences, we were both feeling like frustrated by the industry, we didn't always arrive at the same conclusion. And so Sejal really thought that that was the interesting thing, that we actually were so different in our ideas and thoughts around what was going on, even though we were so similar in where we were coming from. And so she's like, oh, this would be really interesting for people to listen to, like these different perspectives. And how do you reconcile that? And what ended up happening is throughout the process of making the podcast, we found that the more we talked about it, the more we broke down what was really happening, used research, used like information already out there to understand the world a little bit better, like the wellness space, especially a little bit better. We ended up really coming to more and more similar thoughts and conclusions. So even though like we may have different personal attachments to something, like in this case, like the vinyasa episode, Thejal has a more of a love for vinyasa than I do, but at the same time, she recognizes like from the teacher seat, right? We need to view it not just as like our own personal attachment, but what do we want our students to get out of it? And so like, when you think of it, like from these different lenses, you actually do come to more of an understanding. Like, yes, even though in your own personal practice, you may value something else, when you're a teacher, what's your responsibility to the people in the room? And that's going to be different. And that's going to be different when you're the business owner too.
When you were talking about themes, you mentioned you end episodes with action items. That's something that I think is really cool that you incorporate into the kind of the process of the episode. Why was it important for you to put in action items in these episodes?
I'll take that. This is Sejal. It was kind of what Jaisal was saying. When we started to suss out how we were going to deliver this information, we realized we could take the angle of just being personal about it and going through the timeline of events and what we experienced. And that's fine. That's great information. It's more like you're catching up with a friend over a cup of cha or just like hanging out. But in terms of delivering a message to such a broad community and a potentially global community, we didn't want it to end there. We wanted people to relate to personal stories through whatever lens they were looking at it from. And then also say, yeah, I understand what you're saying and I get why there's an issue. What do we do? And we wanted to be able to answer that question saying, here's what we can do. And here's a whole plethora of information to back that up. And then ways to move forward so we can affect positive change. Because we realized the only reason we were putting ourselves out there in this vulnerable way is so that we could affect change and that we wanted to deliver the tools to guide people there.
In the podcast, talk a lot about accessibility, financial accessibility, so many things. How do you incorporate those values into the making and production of the podcast itself?
We've been pretty intentional, I would say. And then we've also been able to review where we kind of made missteps and mistakes to incorporate more accessibility and more of our thoughts into action for the podcast. I've heard this phrase a lot, where your energy, like focus on where your energy and dollars can go to create change. And we wanted to kind of take the same approach. So in creating our concept, and one of the ways we did that was by supporting women and women of color and people of color in making our podcast. So just the logistical aspects of it. Our design is done by someone who lives in Pakistan. Our music was done by a neighbor of mine who is Indian. Our podcast editor is a student of mine, a woman musician. And when we've decided to partner with people externally, we've made an effort to partner with organizations and offer our workshops with organizations that align on our mission of accessibility, inclusivity, and diversity. So we've done that by our workshops being low-cost options with sliding scale. We've offered discounts to our products. We have offered giveaways to see us at our workshop. And our podcast itself is free and accessible to anyone who can find it. And then throughout the process, people ask, do you have transcripts of what you've been doing? I can't hear them. So do you have a way for me to read them? And so we then started working on transcriptions of our podcast. And we have a group of volunteers that helps us transcribe and proofread the transcriptions. And that's also free in a readable format, PDF, and you can get it from our shop. The other thing that was really, really an interesting point of launching this podcast and then it being successful is how much people want to connect to us and share their stories and also give feedback and sometimes offer messaging and questions to us that doesn't feel very safe. So we've taken this approach where we respond to almost every single comment, direct message, and like Facebook message that we receive that doesn't feel threatening and isn't just an obviously hateful message. So we try to foster more communication through that and outside of speaking directly with us, which sometimes we have limited time. I mean, more and more we have limited time. We've created a Facebook group directly through our Yoga is Dead Facebook page that is fostering even more conversation and community and even creating connections locally with people. And then we keep talking about these tips and these ways to move forward. I feel like continuing education is just another way of doing your yoga. You're constantly in inquiry about the things we're talking about and ways to do better in whatever socio-political environment you're in. And so we offer tips at the end of our episodes for the yoga teachers, students, and the yoga business owners on how to move forward with positive change. And we publish that comprehensive and free resource guide on our website so you can continue your investigation and your reading and your work after listening.
You mentioned a bit about kind of the response or at least the community building that has happened since the podcast has aired. Can you tell us, you also mentioned that the making of this has been a really kind of personal experience. Can you tell us a bit about the response of the podcast so far from people and what you both take away from the response and what you leave behind?
Great question. Well, the response has been incredible, more than we could ever have imagined. In like, we haven't even been out for 5 months and we've had in the vicinity of like 75,000 downloads, which to us is like, what? Like, what is that? And so we're just like bowled over by the response. And I would say like, about 90 to 95% of that has just been like overwhelmingly positive. And then of course there's always like going to be some negative reaction or dissent to this sort of these personal stories. And like that was expected from the get-go. So I actually think like on balance, I think what we expected was like it to be the other way around, like negative, and it ended up being like so positive that we're just so happy about it. I think the takeaway that I have from it, or I think even both of us have from this takeaway, is that like people are really ready for these conversations. You said it yourself, like, yeah, you were like so excited and you were just ready for it. Like the issues of that we're talking about have just reached a boiling point in this industry. Like the industry has become large enough that the issues affect so many people in far-reaching places. And I just think that we are just so ready for it. And like representation matters, right? So like as an industry, we are craving more representation and more points of view. And like to the point that studios and teachers are realizing, like looking around and saying like, wow, the room is full of white people. That doesn't seem right. Like even in a diverse city like New York City, we go into a yoga classroom and it's all white. And then you walk out into the street and it's not all white. So it's like there's a disconnect. And people are asking us how to change this. So I think for us, like we're just like, oh, we're on the forefront of something that's was going to happen, a movement that was going to happen regardless. We just happened to be, you know, at the right place at the right time and be ready within ourselves to speak out and have the confidence to finally speak up about our experiences.
Okay. So the theme of Dragon Roots episode today that we're working on is broadly on the topic of wellness. The word wellness can sometimes bring up a lot of different connotations for people. What's your understanding of wellness compared to maybe the images and messages we get about that word?
Well, I'll just say, like, for me, the images I get are so completely different than what I really think about it. So like when I think of wellness, I think of this like something really elite, something you have to like buy, something you have to like subscribe to, become a member of, or like completely adopt. Like, you know, you think of like those pictures of like sweaty, muscled up, skimpily dressed people doing like, you know, crazy workouts and like fad diets and having it all and not having any real stress in their life. And to me, that feels like really unrelatable and unattainable and like this this image of perfection that you can't really get to, versus like the way I really see wellness in my work and in my life is like people who are just tired trying to figure out how to live a better life. And so it, to me, it's really about the day-to-day nitty-gritty and how can we operate better in this like kind of unnatural, weird circumstances that as humans we've created for ourselves. Like we're constantly looking at screens. We're so disconnected from each other in our community and our physical surroundings. And, you know, how can we navigate this in a new way to make us actually feel more connected and more at ease and not as stressed out and not as overwhelmed by the surroundings that we're in?
For the podcast, what are you hoping people walk away with when they listen to it? What do you hope they get out of it?
Well, one, we hope that they learn something from the podcast. And another is, depending on who you are, we hope that you feel really seen and heard through our version of storytelling and research and whatever issues we bring up. And we've kind of experienced that that is the case for a lot of people. We also want people to just open their eyes and perk up and listen before jumping out and taking action and accusing other people of doing anything like what we've experienced. So we hope that people are sitting with the information first and foremost, and then adopting it for themselves before then like accusing others, right? And then the other, like there's a couple other things we want people to do in terms of taking that information and sitting with it. We hope that people start to understand this phrase we use often about living your yoga. And we describe it as a way to not just confine yoga to a space or a practice that you do for 60 minutes, that it's actually a way to live your life and continue asking questions of yourself, continue learning about the history and cultural context of yoga if you practice or teach it, and how to engage with more diverse communities as it affects everyone around you and not just you as an individual. Another major thing we want people to do is understand how to decolonize your wellness practice and space and the way you learn about yoga. So that's such an interesting idea. And it might even be like a catchphrase, decolonize your practice or decolonize your mind. But it's actually thinking about the way you invest your time and money and whether or not it participates in creating imbalanced hierarchies of power. Who are the people in power? We see this like in academia, over 50% of professors are white men. And then they direct the narrative of how we learn information. And this is such an interesting thought exercise. Like when you think about your formal education, can you remember when you had a teacher of color? Can you remember when the books you referenced for your history and your study was written by someone who wasn't, you know, a white person, even when the topic wasn't about white people? So in the yoga world, in the wellness world, we offer suggestions about partnering and learning from people of color, and also taking the time to move out of your safe or comfortable spaces to enter into spaces that are more diverse and more engaging in terms of community and perspective.
Yeah, wow. Amazing. So thank you so much for coming on our show today and chatting with us and taking the time out of your day to do that. I guess just to wrap up, what can people expect from upcoming episodes? Where can they listen? All the deets.
So the upcoming episodes will be released soon. we're still working out the timeline on that, but they're going to focus more on diet culture and body image on one of the episodes, and the other episode will be about the process business, education standards and guidelines around becoming a yoga teacher. So what that looks like and, you know, what we feel about that. Did you ask where people can reach us? Is that what you said?
Yeah, where people can reach you or find you online.
Okay, great. So we have an Instagram handle, which is at Yoga Is Dead Podcast, and a Facebook page, which is just Facebook/ Yoga Is Dead Podcast. You can email us at yogaisdeadpodcast@gmail.com. The only thing that's really different with our social media is the Twitter handle is Yoga Is Dead Pod, since we didn't have enough character space for the whole thing. And then we have a number of ways in which you can support us if you'd like. And so we do recurring donations or subscriptions through our Patreon page, where patrons get special benefits. And we like mail out like fun little gifts. And so that's, and you can join for as little as $2 a month for that. And it's patreon.com/yogaiszedpodcast. You could make a Venmo donation also at Yoga Is Zed Podcast. And then we have a number of things on our website, including you can make a donation on our website. You can shop, buy some swag. You can find our all of our resources listed, all the interviews we've done, and much, much more. And the website is www.yogaiszedpodcast.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much again. You are listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was for Esme, and previous to that was our interview with Yoga Is Dead. We had the chance to record a talk on race and academia. You'll hear from Kim Penny, whose research focuses on queer women of color, speaking about the topic of race in academia.
Okay, so again, I'm Kim Penny. My research focuses on queer women of color who are university scholars and their experience of racism and homophobia. During this talk, I'll discuss the consequences they face in challenging white hegemony and the Canadian academia setting. So we all kind of get the sense that universities and colleges theoretically espouse diversity, and these same institutions still function culturally through Eurocentric imperialism. So one of the things that I've seen is that there seems to be an emphasis on purging of a self-identity and subjectivity that's part of academia regulation that refuses inclusivity and to acknowledge systemic discrimination. So that's basically what I'm seeing, is that they espouse to be, you know, we're great diversity, we have all these, you know, people here, but in essence, when you're in the classroom, it's a very different experience. So my research highlights the persistence of the systemic discrimination in academic institution and explores the sites and practices of resistance for queer women of color. It seeks to give voice to the perspectives of 10, I've talked to 10 queer women scholars, regarding their experiences with and also challenges to this racist structures, process, and discourses that shape their day-to-day experience in the academic setting. So these scholars actually bring a very unique perspective, which is what I was interested in. I was looking at the long history of oppression to the topic of race, racism, gender, and homophobia that they've experienced. And yet, even when they have been the focus of research and efforts in certain educational settings, their voices have been excluded from educational discourses and in those settings. So when I was looking at, you know, my kind of research topic and thinking about this, and, you know, you have to kind of do a lit review of what, you know, what's out there, I really didn't find much that discussed this particular issue. So this is kind of what gave me the impetus to do this. Also, my personal experience of being a graduate student teaching undergrad classes prompted me to kind of really look more at this particular topic. So I found that these women struggle daily to negotiate their professional and personal identities within a web of socially constructed notions that what it means to be queer, female, and a racial minority in Canada, not so much in Canada, but also in the Canadian institutions. So two places I looked at was McGill and I looked at Boise. So these scholars are subjected to the same school culture as that of their queer female students of color, and they also must deal with the issues of racism, sexism, and homophobia in their daily work. Thus, they're unlikely to escape the material consequences of prejudice and discrimination embedded in university culture. More often than not, queer women of color find that despite their relative position of power within the university walls, they are too victims of marginalization and subordination. Queer women of color scholars reported a clear difference in climate working conditions dependent on the whiteness of the university and the environment. So my experience at McGill, where I also had my undergrad and first master's there, and when I looked at the queer black women teaching there, was very different from the people that I was talking at OIS University, which is in Toronto. Their experience was very different in terms of the climate there, where there was more people of color in not only students, but faculty representation. Their experience was a lot more positive. My McGill professors had some real challenges, and that kind of, I looked at what that core thing was about. So the scholars that I basically was looking at, I looked at what they were, how they engaged their course material, and what was the experience of their interaction with students. So the scholars experienced resistance from white students that ranged from insistence on maintaining Eurocentric readings of course materials to the expression of overt anger at having to explore racism, homophobia, or colonialist relations in their courses. All of these scholars had common experience with each, and each woman reported that she experienced hostility from white students, and these aggressions became internalized, resulting in damaging effects to them, actually, personally. Students, and one of the things that I think students may realize or not, is that they have a power that is not acknowledged to disenfranchise them as instructors because they are uncomfortable with the course content. We all know that we all get evaluations probably somewhere in the, you know, 6 weeks of the course. How well do you like it? Is the teacher competent and all this? And us scholars are very aware of how we are perceived And whether the students have that power to actually see whether we're going to be reinstated or whether we're going to be getting future course assignments. So they also reported when they started teaching about racism, the tension in the room was clear. Students were deathly quiet, still, and glaring and hostile. Some white students openly denied oppression and claimed there was no racism in Canada. They refused to question their own assumptions about race. Instead, they invested in racial denial, which tends to engender a profoundly disingenuous and innocent that amounts to transgressive refusal to know. So, you know, it's like, well, Obama's president, you know, everything's fine in, you know, like post-racial society. And a lot of students were really, entrenched in this kind of notion that, you know, race and homophobia was something of the past, and now we've just kind of moved on from that. And I want to suggest that these students invest in not knowing because they, if they knew that this means they would have to kind of acknowledge their own complicity with their own privilege, with their own racist notion, and of course with their own homophobia aspects of their behavior. So I think they're very invested in kind of looking at that outward instead of looking at that inward. The women of color also reported that the issue of homophobic language, rhetoric, and epithets supported by a homonormative environment remains the most tolerated discriminatory speech used by students in the classroom. So I can attribute this. I was teaching like an intro class, and I was at the front of the class, and I heard, you know, kids talking about, oh, that's so gay, and he's this, and he's that, in a very derogatory way. No one pushed back, no one said, hey, what's going on here? It was just part of the culture. I was also at the time sitting, as I said, in front of the class, and the student would come up to me and say, oh, are you the TA for the class? When's the prof coming? Who's the prof? They never expected me to be their prof. It's not even something that is in their imagination that I could actually be teaching them or even have some knowledge to be passed on. And I think this has to do a lot with the Canadian white narratives. I think that, you know, they really place Black, Indigenous, and other racialized people in a dysphoria that is devoid of the center of Pacific culture, space, and time with its own sacred history and language and culture. And what I mean by this, it's really when we look at our textbooks, when we look at our history that we're taught in schools, our history is denied. My history is denied. Indigenous history is denied. I happen to, my people have been here for 400 years. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the Nova Scotian Black Canadians that you hear about. And so when I talk to people about that, they don't even realize that Blacks were in Canada 400 years ago. So it's not part of our conversation. I question as a little kid why that was. I never read anything about any people of color in Canada. It was just whitewashed. And also I think it also has a point of the Canadian multicultural landscape that we're all fine, we've long ago banished the stereotypes from our head and we're innocent subjects standing outside the social relations and there's no accountability for the past, and it's not implicated in the present. So this is that kind of, like I said, kind of denial of the history. So I think for women, these women in general, there was definitely consequences to challenging, kind of the white establishment. And it really resulted in them being marginalized and being othered by students from a dominant group who rendered them incompetent, aggressive, and challenged their legitimacy as scholars. This was constant challenge, constant refusal to kind of engage in any scholarship that was out, that was a discomfort for them. And I mean very aggressively. And to me it was kind of curious because they chose to take the class. So, and you know, this was like, you know, racism, this was just, it's not like it was a surprise what we were gonna be discussing. So I kind of found this kind of interesting that they came to class, they chose this, it's not, you know, it's an elective, but yet the material made them very uncomfortable. And so they, instead of dealing with that feeling, it was projected on myself and other scholars as well. So I felt when I was talking to my research subjects, a lot of them said that there's a constant battle between the consciousness and subjectivity in relation to knowledge and power, and norms of racial conformity that render and that are prized in academia. And basically what I mean by this is kind of, you know, we, I think, when I say we, I'm queer and I'm Black and I'm, you know, a teacher, an educator, and I think there's that tightrope balance of trying to kind of figure out, making sure that, you know, you have a job next semester, and yet you don't want to compromise who you are as an individual. You also want to have your intellectual know-how and stuff be respected and being able to share that process and people to be engaged in that. And I think that's something that we, you know, we often struggle with as Black queer scholars. So, and I just also want to kind of close with a couple of things. One, that all of them found that the university institutional kind of administration was not supportive. In fact, if there were any issues with their students, we were blamed for not having control of our students, and we should, you know better. You know, it kind of, if we had any issues, we were reluctant to bring them forth because, you know, that would mean, you know, we'd not likely get a job next semester. And also, you know, there's that's one of the things that it's, remaining silent is a double-edged sword. Yes, you get the job next semester, but at the same time, you're compromising yourself professionally, emotionally, and spiritually. And I think being silent means that you become complicit in the, you know, in terms of the whiteness silencing you. And I think that's very challenging for a lot of women of color in institutions. And finally, I'll just say that most of these women kind of saw themselves as change agents and really trying to kind of open up a dialogue, a healthy dialogue and discussion about race, homophobia, and kind of sexism in academia. And it was, you know, their colleagues, their white colleagues were not that supportive. and of course, the institutions were not that supportive, even though they offer all of these courses. And so one of the things that we'd like to kind of look at, or I'd like to kind of look more at, is basically how do we get that change to take place? What is it that it's going to take for things to really look at addressing some of the systemic issues that we see in institutions regarding racism and homophobia?
Oh, how long winds they blow.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was Akua, followed by a recording about racism in academia. And earlier on in the show, we were speaking with the founders of Yoga is Dead. We've come to the end of today's edition of Dragon Root Radio, but be sure to tune in 2 Mondays from now for more reports on gender-based issues.
Come distant heart, fearful child, I want you to never cried for you. I moved away too fast, but now you're in my dreams, a disease in my chest. If I find a way to love this house of bones that I can't live without, I dig you up from underground and fall into forever.
Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
Le Festival international de Nuit d'Afrique is back with its free outdoor programming from July 9th to the 24th in Montreal. Meet at the Patière in the Quartier des Spectacles and on the new L'Esplanade Tranquille. For the first time, a second scene for twice as many concerts and free activities for the whole family. On the program, concerts, open-air workshops, DJ sets, restaurants with tropical flavors, and don't forget the Timbuktu Market. Discover the festival like you've never seen it before. Programming on festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Fabienne Collat et la Banque TD vous invitent au 16e festival Haïti en folie du 25 au 31 juillet. Au programme Bingo Night avec Kako, gastronomie, artisanat, littérature, spectacle gratuit de Corneille, Bello, Paul Beaubrun, Will Butler, Dark and Fire, Wesley, Rebecca Jean, Kelly Crow, Yama Laurent, Raccoon, Défilé Rara et plus de 150 artistes. Aïe aïe aïe! Haïti en folie, c'est Haïti comme vous ne l'avez encore jamais vu du 25 au 31 juillet au quartier des Spectacle, Parc La Fontaine et Cabaret La Tulipe. Info, haitienfolie.com.
This summer, I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings, and I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have 2 phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
NTSS.